Welcome to the OA Light a Candle Meeting Podcast. Visit our website at www.oalaig.org, where you'll find over 4 speaker feeds with over 400 speaker files, links for you to subscribe to the podcast, and a place where you can donate to keep this special service active. I would now like to introduce our speaker for tonight, Alan.
Hi, my name is Alan. I'm a compulsive overeater. Hi, thanks for asking me to speak. I always say yes whenever I'm asked to speak, and I've been asked 4 times in the last 2 weeks, which is very, more people on this side than on this side. It's kind of weird. I'm very nervous. It's very intense. I just want to ask, you know, my prayer lately has been that God help me be of service. And I was praying while I was sitting here, you know, and that is my prayer as I go into the beginning of my day and as I go into any activity I take on during the day, because I'm very willful and I'm very self-aggrandizing and deprecating at the same time. And so, you know, I just need to be of service to others, and so I hope if I say something comprehensible or intelligent or helpful that it's not me, it's God, so I'm going to try to help myself by speaking from my heart about what this program has saved my life, about what this program is, because this program has saved my life. So I'll just talk numbers to start with, because numbers have been, my brain has been filled with the numbers lately. I don't know why that happens to me over periods of time, but so I came into the program in 2003, and I got abstinent in 2008, around the time of my mother's funeral. Actually, around exactly at the day of her funeral, when they ordered all these, platters of fish. That's what Jews do. You have to have food at the funeral, at the afterwards, when people come back to your house. My sister and brother came in from other parts of the country, and I had platters of smoked fish and bagels, many, many bagels. And I, you know, decided I had the choice to either sit next to that fish and bagels and just eat them, which I love. Or I could actually try to experience the day of, you know, my mother is dead, and my brother and sister are here, and all these people are here, and so I made a choice that day to experience the day, and then one day rolled into another day, and then all of a sudden I realized, oh, so this must be an actual abstinence that I'm working on, I've lost 70 pounds over the last whatever it is, and I've been fluctuating, and this again, the numbers, you know, they're fluctuating between 205 and 215. I started around 280. I'm not good with math, so, but I do know what the numbers are, and I don't know why, but those numbers are flying through my brain lately. I want to weigh less. I've been married for 40 years. My wife is magnificent. I love her. She loves me. She doesn't even, like, I'll shave my beard. She doesn't even notice. I get heavy and thin. She doesn't notice. I mean, or she claims that. I don't think she does. She's a very spiritual person, and she deals with what is rather than what she sees. It's quite extraordinary. And I have 2 grown sons and 2 grandchildren, and I have a career, and my life is good. I do a lot of things, but no contentment, no serenity, no... That's what drove me into these rooms, was all that outside stuff, all the, you know, it's the, you know, all the stuff of accolades and ooh, wow, ooh, hey, and inside I'm like, I'm an old, fat, bald piece of shit. And that was one of the tapes in my brain. I'm an old, fat, bald, you know. And you may now fill in the rest of that. And that was, you know, even when I was younger, I already had that tape. And it was kind of like a joke tape that I would repeat over and over and over. And I realized it's so mean. If I had a friend who said to me about himself or herself, that I'm an old, fat, whatever piece of... I would say, what? No, come on. I mean, wouldn't we... I would do that to a friend. I would, come on. Look at this and look at that, and you're magnificent. Look how kind you are, and look how generous. And but for myself, I had no kindness for myself at all. And And this program had helped me. I had a therapist years ago who said, Serenity? Alan? I don't know. Calmer? Could probably get you calmer. Well, that's a step towards serenity, such as it is. And without this program, I would be dead. Because, you know, I've heard all these aphorisms, all these phrases that these rooms have taught me that I just love because they're quick, they're right. You know, take it easy, one day at a time, one step at a time, progress not perfection. It's an inside job. It's so helpful because it's a touchstone for me. It reminds me that it's a spiritual process. It's a spiritual program. It's what's happening inside of me. For me, God is that still small voice that if I could just shut up and stop this committee chattering at me, the monkey mind, and there's a whole group of them chattering and swinging around inside my brain. If I could just be still for a moment, I could hear maybe something that's true, deeply true. I'm deeply scared of dying. I have not as scared as I used to be when I was little. I was little, I would sit up and it would be like this cold, dark, like a knife through me, like, that there would be end. And I would eat. And I would, you know, anesthetize some of that fear. And I remember my son, my younger son, who's now a grown man, would say to me, son, but you won't know. You're dead. What's the deal? I'd say, you're right, honey. You're right. What do you know? But, you know, the fear that drives me. You know, I was talking about my mother. I said this at a meeting one time. I never in my life felt comfort from my mom. Look, I'm 61 years old. None of this is going to be my mother's fault anymore, if it ever was. You know what I mean? We're all just people. She did her best. She had a horrible life. I mean, the trappings were excellent, but her childhood was a disaster. So she did the best she could, but there was no warm comfort. There was protection. I used to call it the Batmobile. You know what I mean? If there was a problem, boom, she'd rush in, you know. But there was no warm, like people talk about, you know, I watched my wife pick up when our sons were little, and I watched my daughter-in-law pick up my grandchildren, and that warm, that thing that we all want, that enveloping and that loving cuddle. I don't remember that ever, in a metaphorical or in a literal sense, obviously. But you know what? For me, you know, I was fine in terms of, you know, if that's the biggest emotional hurdle that I had to face, I mean, that was my life. But I remember food was always my very best friend. So what was it like? It was just really so chaotic and bizarre. I remember I was an overeater from the time I was very, very little. Very little. Love food. I still love food. And I don't want this program to make me not love food. I love food. I love to look at it. I like the pictures. You go to a Japanese restaurant, they're, ooh, look what the rolls look like. Ooh. Now, I won't order all of them like I used to. You know, but I love food. And a friend of mine said years ago, and it's before I was in program, we were somewhere. I was traveling for work, and we went to a restaurant, and I was ordering, and I was smiling, and he said to me, yeah, you can always count on food, it'll never let you down, right? It's like your best friend. And I was like, but it was true. You know, it was true. I remember as a child, it was so easy. And it was also the one time where, as a family, we would get together and have dessert. We'd bring trays up to my parents' bedroom, ice cream. Dessert, and we'd all sit down together, and that was like that was the warmth. That was that thing. That was as close to that comfort as I had in my childhood. There was food, and it's pretty simple food, right? I mean, you don't have to talk to it or have a relationship. It's like internet. It's just. You know what I mean? But it's. And as a child, it was very important in my family growing up, presentation. What will the neighbors think? How do you present yourself? You know, my parents were, my mother was really immigrant. I mean, you know, they're first generation, they were born here, but but, you know, nothing, poverty, I mean, like, dirt poor, like, nothing. And you know, I was brought up in a very upper middle class household in a gorgeous neighborhood, which I went back for my 40th high school reunion a few years ago, and I went, well, it's even more privileged than I remember. This is like, oh my gosh, this is terrifying. The lawns are so manicured, I want to throw up. I mean, it was like, where do you, it was, anyway, that's my reaction. But the presentation was very important, and I remember, you know, that you had to look a certain way and dress, and my mother was always embarrassed by how, you know, how fat I was, and it just did not right, and we had to go shopping twice a year, and we'd buy new wardrobes, and the size was never right, and I had to go in the back. I said this at another meeting just recently. I went to the back of the room with the husky department, the men, you're not old enough to remember. Now they just have it all out, and it's all good, but it was the husky department, which was like, you know, you had to go through the clothes, you know, like in the back, like in the cave, come to the husky department, you know, it was, and you know, it was humiliating. It was a humiliation. It was like, husky, well, we can sew these two pants together and wrap it around one leg. And, you know, I was the first to make the joke. I'm fast. I'm glib. That's my thing. Aikido. I learned that early on. I'm funny. You know, and I learned to be funny and clever because I don't want you to hurt me. It works to some extent. And to another extent, it doesn't really. And it keeps you away from people. And I remember, I won't do too much of this because it was like that for all of us. I mean, we all have stories about the disaster. But I remember my brother convinced my parents to send him to the Virgin Islands. I'm from Long Island, from New York. My brother convinced my parents to send him to the Virgin Islands on a vacation. He was in college, and I was not. I was in, I don't remember, ninth grade or something. But he was too fat to go. And be in a bathing suit. And I was thin at that time in my life. And I remember standing on my parents' bed trying on all the clothes that I had. Said, look how thin I look. Maybe I should go to the Virgin Islands. I mean, it's amazing, this memory that I have. And my parents would go, yes. And then they would compare me to him. See? He should go. Because he looks like he could. Really? I mean, what is that? That is just twisted. Right? That's twisted. I mean, it's not like, you know, Abu Ghraib twisted, you know, but it's twisted. It's little passive aggressive moments of humiliation. They're all through my childhood. When I was young, my father was an orthodontist. He's still alive. He's 95. He's very funny. And since my mother died, he talks a lot. He had a non-speaking role in his own life. I'm serious. I mean, I remember my brother and I turning around saying, who is this guy? He's telling stories. I'm like, dude, really? I mean, I'm 61, he's 95. It's like, I've never heard these stories. He said, oh, yeah, I thought I told you. I never heard them. He had no time to talk, but he was not really allowed to talk. But he was an orthodontist with a script, you know, a prescription. It's just dangerous, those things. And he gave me Ambar when I was young, which is an amphetamine barbiturate combination. And I would take two in the morning. I think I told this at another meeting earlier. Anyway, two in the morning and one at lunch. And I was 12 or something. And, you know, it was cold. I grew up in New York, so I had to wear a t-shirt, a shirt, a sweater, and a jacket. And, you know, by 9, I'm like pouring sweat because I'm speeding my brains out. You know, and then the barbiturate kicks in later on because it's a combination pill. And then you get like kind of, and I, you know, I was just flying all over on this roller coaster. And a few years later, a friend of mine said, oh, dude, it's speed. It's easy. You smoke a joint later in the day, whoosh, takes the edge right off. Excellent. So now I'm in the chemistry experiment of my part of my life. Like, you know, flour, sugar, salt, speed, you know. Ah, wow, wait, slow down. Oh, good. Oh. And so, you know, I had a lot of drugs. I love drugs. Oh, my God, I love drugs. But I'm trying to keep it, it's related to my food. Because my father gave me this Escitrol, which is a time-release spanchel, which if you poke the hole in it, it releases it more quickly. And I would save it up and then give it out during finals. because what's the point of getting high by yourself? Right? And I would give it out to people, and we'd just speed our brains out all during finals and writing. And then I'd smoke, you know, a bunch of weed, and then I would eat. Then I would go by myself and eat for 3 or 4 hours, and then have another sort of crash and another coma. It is kind of like a coma. It's weird. Yeah, I mean, I laugh about it. It's funny, because it's funny. It was funny, you know, and I'm alive, and there's a kind of Dionysian appetite that I really like, and that I really sort of celebrate, but I just don't want it to kill me. And I think that's a trick. Because, you know, Mardi Gras is just for a week. You know, you can't spend that out for 3 months. Because then you're a drug addict, or an alcoholic, or an overeater, or all of them put together, and eventually you die. And then my drugs and alcohol, so I got into the program. Where am I? Oh, God help me. So, you know, so I went around and did that. I've been on all these diets, every diet in the history of the world. I mean, every diet in the history of the world. You know, and I've lost it. Where are you going? You're going to bring a note back? You're going to bring a note? A hall monitor? I'm not paranoid. Just because Cindy doesn't mean she is out to get me. She's going to... anyway, I'm sorry. I'm so twisted. I've lost and gained hundreds of pounds, and I was pride myself that if I could get that click, getting that groove, that track, I could drop weight quickly. And I did that. Gain a lot of weight and then drop a lot of weight. Gain a lot of weight and drop a lot of weight. And then at a certain point, I guess around 50, my body just said, no, you can't do that anymore. No, and my heart was like, what are you doing? Because it's really unbearably dangerous. My son is a recovering heroin and crack addict. And he brought us into this universe of 12 steps. And now I regard tattoos and young people and middle-aged people and older people all differently when I see tattooing and piercing. And it's either, oh, so you're either a recovering drug addict, or you just got out of prison, or you're just like young and you like to tattoo. I don't, you know, it's a generational split for me. But it really was interesting, and we went to family therapy. We went to lots of therapy when we went into this 12-step universe. I was terrified and embarrassed and terrified that my son was going to die. And we were sitting at the family therapist. I had a therapist, my wife had a therapist, our son had a therapist, we had a family therapist. We did whatever we were told. It was the first time I was, part of my work, as the work that I do, is I do what I'm told. So I understand how to take direction. And then argue about it later. But take direction and do it, and then you can argue later. But try it. So I understand that. So we were given all this direction. We were sitting at a family therapy meeting, and the therapist turns to me and says, well, what about you? What are you going to do? And I was like, me? He's a heroin addict. What have I got to do with anything? I'm eating donuts. I've got like a box. I wish I scripted this, but I have a box. And I mean Krispy Kreme. We're talking like, you know, double Ben and Jerry's. You know, one of the guys has a taste bud issue. I don't know if you know this about Ben and Jerry. And so he doesn't taste, it's double butterfat and double sugar because his taste buds are not as attuned. That's why it's so fabulous. I was in New York. I was working in New York, and I did an experiment. What would happen if you ate 2 pints of Ben and Jerry's ice cream every night for 8 months? And it turns out you gain an enormous amount of weight. So I've done that research for you. I was funded by Ben and Jerry's Foundation for the year that I was gone. It was a very interesting experiment. No, I mean literally, I ate 2 pints on the way home every night, Chunky Monkey and Cherry Garcia. I'm consistent, if nothing else. So I'm sitting there, and I say, I'm eating these donuts, and I said to the therapist, I said, well, maybe I have an issue with food. I don't know. My son bursts out laughing. But not, you know, not in a kind of nasty way, just in that spectacular. He has this magnificent laugh, which is like, oh, welcome to reality. And I mean, this was only, I don't know, 11, 12 years ago. I mean, I know, I get it. Yes, I have a hole that can't be filled. And I need God. It's an inside job. I need God in my life to fill my hole. Yeah, fill this hole. I don't know. I mean, I've got an edge of, you know, I'm from Long Island, you know, and my wife, I started going to these meetings. And I went to what used to be a sister program, which is not any longer, I was told, on Tuesday. And it was just so rigid. And I was like, you know, no, I can't do it. It's too rigid. It's too much. Am I done? Should I shut up? It's freezing. I'm freezing all of a sudden. It was too rigid. Anything that's rigid says you have to do this, I rebel immediately. So I ran away. That showed him. And went to another expensive food plan. And all the food plans are fantastic. I mean, I want to say that because my food plan. So anyway, so I did that, and eventually I crawled back into the rooms in 2003, and it took me 5 years to put together an actual abstinence. And I had my early sponsors. I had my early sponsor who was like a kumbaya. Oh, it's beautiful. You know, I love you. You're fine. I was like, oh my God. I love you too, but I need actual direction. I need boundaries. My friends in New York used to call me dancing indiscreet. I have no discretion. I have no sense of boundaries. I don't know how to form a. I need a boundary. And I went through several sponsors, many of whom were wonderful. One early sponsor said, just remember, when you read the tools, thinking is not one of the tools. And that really helped me, because, boy, when I get up in here and I rationalize and figure out, I was really rewarded as a child for figuring things out and knowing how it works. And that really avails me nothing. Thinking is not one of the tools, but it was a good thing to hear because I remember it to this day. And thank you. And then I tore my Achilles tendon and I was laid up in my house for months. And I thought, this is it. I've been crouching around. I found an abstinence. It took me years to separate abstinence from food plan. Because I thought if I'm calling myself abstinent but I'm not strict on my food plan, then I'm lying. But then I realized, well, my abstinence is basically no binging and three meals a day. And my food plan changes because I've got to have some leeway in my life. Otherwise, I run screaming to the donut or the burritos or something carby. I'm a carby guy and oily carby bread and mayonnaise. Bread, mayonnaise, and salsa. So my food plan keeps changing, but I put together 30 days and 60 days, and I put together a year and several years, and I had several years of abstinence, and my food plan was wildly running, and I just needed to lose weight because I was going to die or become diabetic. And I said, oh, you're pre-diabetic. And my doctor said, no, you know, that's like you're a little pregnant. You're diabetic or you're not diabetic. Your body, your the insulin, now it may not be, maybe reversible. That is to say, your pancreas may not have given up. And it may not have become insulin resistant. But I was, my liver and my pancreas, they were just in trouble. And all the numbers said it. And I was like, God, so mad at myself, which is helpful. And I'm being ironic, of course. It's not. I mean, to learn to love myself first. To let the people in the rooms love me before I could love myself. If I could love myself as much as my wife loves me, or my children love me, or my friends in this room, the families in this fellowship love me, it took me years. And I still am touch and go with that. And I found a food plan that I was willing to stay on, and I dropped the weight very quickly. And I've been playing with these 10 pounds for the last year, between 205 and 250, and I'd like to get down to 190. Those are the numbers that are. I'm 5'10. I'm 5'8 and a half. I said I'm 5'10. My oldest son said, "No, you're not. You're really not." So I'm 5'11, and you're much shorter than I am. I said, "Okay, so now I don't lie about it, and I don't lie about my sizes. Part of what I do, I have to know what my sizes are, my measurements, and I know." And then now I'm sort of confused because I'm in between, and people who take that information and create clothing for you don't really care what your sizes are. They just want to solve their problem, which is getting clothes that fit you. So if you lie to them, it doesn't endear you. And in general, lying really doesn't endear you. Well, sometimes I thought it does. Right? I would lie sometimes because I thought it would. And then it would screw me up because then I would forget, you know, which lie did I tell? That's a book that it's very good. Anyway, so I tore my Achilles tendon and I'm wheeling around in my house on this chair that gets me all around my house, and I can't walk and I can't exercise, and I thought I'd be 750 pounds in oh no, a friend of mine said, "You can't gain that much weight." Oh really? Okay. Here we go. Because that to me is a challenge. You know, I mean, it sounds glib, but I'm being serious. That's a challenge for you. Oh, it's too sweet. It's too rich. Who could eat that whole dessert? Really? Too sweet? Too rich? This is Greek. My daughter-in-law is Greek, so you know, kind of spare it to everyone. But I mean, I don't get it. So I went on this food plan, and it's small amounts of food. It turns out if you eat small amounts of food, you lose weight. Now I was so high when that memo came to my house that I don't remember reading it. So whatever food plan I use, it has to include small portions. And honestly, you could exercise from now till Shavuos, which is a Gaelic holiday, and you won't lose weight. Because to burn 3,500 calories, which is 1 pound of fat, you have to be in the gym for many, 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 many hours doing very vigorous exercise. It's good for your body, for your cardio, for your... So now I'm playing with my food plan a little bit. I stay on it most of the time. I'm going to New York on Monday. I have reservations at two wonderful restaurants. But that's not a red light. That's not a green light for, well, as I get to the airport, I might as well pick up $65 worth of X. You know, usually it has to do with pastries and candies and bags of stuff that you can eat. Because to me, as to most of us, a serving is a bag. That's right. That's a bag of whatever. That's a serving. You can't close the door, you get a little clip. Yeah. You roll the top and put a clip on. Oh, it got stale. We might as well eat it. It's a game. It's a game. It's a game for me, and I don't want to play the games. I'm exhausted from playing the games, and I don't want to die, because as I said earlier, I am terrified of dying. And I'm a little better now, because I find some quiet time when, you know, I can feel that there is God, and that there is something that I'm part of that's more than me. God, I hope so. But I don't want to die because of what I've done. I don't want to kill myself. You know, what I've heard in the rooms also is alcohol and drugs are like a tornado. They rip your house to pieces. And overeating is like termites. And it destroys your house, but it's just slower. And you don't sort of notice it. You know, all of a sudden, slowly, oh, you're diabetic. How did that happen? I don't know. I really don't know. I don't know how. Because it's a habit. You know, when I started coming to these rooms, a friend of mine said, it's like brainwashing. I said, well, my brain could use a little washing. Because right now, food is my higher power. And fear was my higher power. So if it takes me a while to act as if... That's part of my training too. I know how to act as if. I understand the magic if. If I were a thin person, how might I eat? If I were to love myself, how might I behave? If I were to believe in God, because I was raised, you know, with a God of punishment. And how about this poem, huh? That the God is not a punishing God. That's a sort of Messiah. Right? I was raised with a punishing God, a God of vengeance. Shalmash's play, God of Vengeance. And that really was like, really? And I believe that there's some more loving force of creation, of light. And that's what I want to go towards. That's what this program has shown me. I was a spiritual seeker for many, many years. I lived in San Francisco for a long time, in the 70s and 10 years. And it was just, you know, it was the beginning of a real searching for spiritual life. And I've continued that. There was a long period of householding that got in my way. But this program has taught me a plan of living which has a spiritual component, a physical component, which is my food plan. And I realized that if I follow the steps and do what I'm told, there's a chance I can find some serenity and ease and peace in my life. And I just treat people better. My wife and I have been together a long time, for 40 years. And it's taken me a long time, as with my children and their children, to learn to shut up. I don't have to react to everything. Oh yeah, you know what? Phil Everly, who died. It's my belief pride is the chief cause of the decline in the numbers of husbands and wives. And my pride, you know, my position of rightness. No one really cares. And it doesn't really matter. It doesn't matter. Would you rather be right or would you rather be president? Would you rather be right or would you rather take a breath and just think about it and not react and maybe respond later out of a loving, kind place rather than out of an ego, prideful, hurt place? I didn't have any of that before this program. And I'm grateful every day for the opportunity to have a plan of getting through the day. I don't know how people without a program, how they manage. Because life is tricky. And it's a cabaret, right? It's a twisted little roller coaster through a lot of dark and a lot of light. And I love the extremes. I love the drama. I love the party of it. But I don't want to be sucked into the hell of it. And so when I'm turned into a dark place, and I have a very dark place in my mind, I just try to remember to breathe and to find God somewhere. Someone said it in the room the other day, God doesn't go away. I may go away, and when I come back, God's going, hey, what's up? Welcome back. That's right. And that God is a more open-minded. Anyway, so thank you for letting me speak, and I hope something made sense and was helpful.